I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to Your Money Matters, brought to you by MeQ. We're back here with Justin and Stephanie Jones-Fosu, a couple who practice frugal living. They will give us their frugality tips, and we welcome you to send your ideas to a special Steiner Show email, moneymatters@steinershow.org. We'll share your ideas on future Money Matters segments as we come up. Justin, of course, is a familiar voice on WEAA. He hosts his own program, Listen Up with Justin Jones-Fosu and Leadership in 60. So, Justin and Stephanie, welcome back.
I'm glad to be back.
Thanks for having us.
So, now, when we left off, you're $130,000 in debt.
Yeah.
You have $800 in 3 or 4 months you spent on non-grocery-related food.
Yeah.
So,
no.
No, nothing to show for it, except calories.
Because people want to just go out to eat.
Yeah.
I'm going to get a drink, get a burger, get a this, get a that, whatever. So it adds up.
It does.
Mm-hmm.
Quickly.
It's amazing how much it adds up, Mark.
So what did you do? What did you all do?
Well, I read the book. After I read the book, Total Money Makeover by Dave Ramsey, I read it in 4 days because I just soaked it up. And it, you know, I'd gone through business school, Mark. I had taken accounting one, taken accounting two, statistics, finance. I'd taken all that. I did my MBA, took accounting one, accounting two. But I still never knew how to manage my personal finances. And it wasn't until reading that book that it changed my mind on how I looked at finances. Because, you know, we're on college campuses, you're sold debt. You know, they tell you, you know, hey, take the debt. And I like the lifestyle. You know, I thought that we earned our right to live the way we're living. You know, we graduated. We have arrived. And what I realized is that we were spending frivolously. And we had to really take a hard look at what was essential versus what was a luxury. And before then, I thought a lot of things that were luxury were essential.
Yeah, I definitely, you know, and after he finished reading it, I read it as well. I think by the time he was done, it was like around Christmas. Obviously, it was obviously Christmas that motivated it. So during Christmas break, I read it in like a week. And, you know, and that, you know, when you decide to become frugal, especially if you're married, it's important that both the husband and wife are on board because you can't do it by yourself. And, you know, both of us, we put our funds in the same pot and it goes out, you know. And so after, you know, I remember I think we were going in to get one of the car that we actually ended up selling fixed. I think it just dawned on me, oh my gosh, this car is not paid for. And it's like, we don't have to do this anymore. We don't have to live like this anymore. We don't have to live paycheck to paycheck. We don't have to struggle all the time if we just implement this really simple suggestions that were offered in the book that I think we all know, but we just didn't put it together. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, when one of his mantras is like, live like no one else so you can live like no one else. And I think that when you scale back on things that you think that you have to have, like we thought we had to have cable. We thought that we both had to have a car. You know, we thought that we had to do certain things.
You don't have cable?
No, that was one of the first things that we got rid of.
You know, when you start putting a dollar amount to things, Mark, it really makes you think, when did you need it? You know, because we looked at cable and we said, if we cut off cable, we'll save over $720 a year. And we didn't think that way before. Before it was just, oh, it's just, you know, $60 a year, $60 a month. You know, we need it.
That was a necessity.
But we said, how else can we do it? And that's the thing. You know, when you start to live frugal, you figure out different ways to do things. So we say, you know what? Are we watching a lot of this stuff? No, not really. So why don't we just get the internet, which is, we got a deal for $35.99 a month at that time. And we can watch the shows online, you know, and so we stopped, you know, we can go on CNN.com, we can do this. And so we just used the internet to watch our TV. So we cut off our TV, our cable, and we just got the general channel. So we not only cut off our cable, but we realized, you know what, I work in D.C., I work in Virginia, you know, I can, you know, I catch the train, we don't need 2 cars. So we figured out a way and we sold the other car. So we wouldn't have a car note one. We also wouldn't have added insurance. And so all that stuff, we started putting dollar amounts to it and money that we could save. And we realized that when we were looking from paycheck to paycheck monthly, that now we could really find the money to not only save, but to start getting out of debt.
Now, how old are the two of you?
I'm 29.
30.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. This is because it's a young people's world we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. It's very rare for young people to do what you have tackled. So I'm going to ask you, would you be willing to sit through, come back one more time?
Absolutely.
For some more tips? All right. We're sitting here talking with Justin and Stephanie Jones-Fosu. You know those names. They're here on WEAA. And you're listening to Your Money Matters, brought to you by MeQ. MeQ Invest in Yourself, and we'll invest in you. For more information, 1-800-248-MECU or www.mecu.com. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. There is an amazing exhibit about to open up at the James E. Lewis Museum of Art on Morgan State University campus on August the 7th. It's called 20 Years of Peaceful Passion, the African-American Quilters of Baltimore. And it runs through September the 30th. It's quilts made by, as they put, non-traditional traditionalists. And we are joined in our studios now by the president of the African-American Quilters Association, Janet Walters, and Vera Hall and Paula Rooks, all of whom are quilters, and my old friend Vera Hall, I have not seen her in years and didn't know she was a quilter till this moment. Ladies, welcome. Good to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
It's wonderful to be here.
They really didn't know we had this other side of Vera Hall.
Yes, that's my peaceful side.
I like that. That's a good side, Vera. That's a great side.
Not fighting with anybody but material.
You know, this is fascinating. We're about to, folks, in the course of this conversation, and you can go to our website at steinershow.org and see some of the pictures of the quilts that we're talking about. And go to the exhibit and see them even more, up close and personal. But you can see what we're talking about as we talk about them if you wish to. Just go to steinershow.org and they'll be there on the site under African-American Quilters. We had G's Bend on a few years back when they were here, the women from G's Bend, the exhibit was at the Walters. And it's really funny because I'd like you all to speak to this question of quilting just in general for a moment, because we have this idea for a long time that there were no African-American quilters. And then on the other side, there's this idea with people now going, the quilting is part of the African-American world. It's this interesting world that's been created. Whoever would like to jump off, please do.
Well,
Janet Walters.
I think that thought permeated with people, because so often, if you are not part of mainstream culture, the things that you do are really not seen. Mm-hmm. And so many African-American quilts from the 1800s did not survive because they were used till they were shreds. So a lot of times there was no evidence that early quilts even existed.
Well, I can relate one story that just is proof positive that we were very active in quilting. I think any group who was around fantastic scraps or not-so-fantastic scraps would have tried to innovate and make something from them. And there was this woman whose name was Elizabeth Keckley, who was Abraham Lincoln's dressmaker, Abraham Lincoln's wife's dressmaker.
Who was African-American.
And she was African-American. And so as I read descriptions when I was doing research on the Civil War quilt, I said, this woman had to have made a quilt. So I kept looking and looking and looking, finally found that she had given the quilt to a college. Her son went to Wilberforce. Her son was actually killed in the Civil War. And it's made of the silks and all of the fine fabrics that she would have encountered being a dressmaker in Washington, D.C. Mm. She bought her freedom through her sewing skills and opened a dressmaking shop in D.C. And she came to the attention of the Lincolns because of her skill. And so I hope one day to see the real quilt.
It exists still?
It still exists. It's, you know, it's not in great shape, but it's been preserved. And there's another two quilts by Harriet Powers.
Yes.
The Bible quilt and one that's the animals and all, like, I can't remember the title of that one. But one exists at the Smithsonian and the other one is at the Boston Museum. And so they were applique quilts.
Which means what?
Which means that the designs were taken from something and put onto a piece of fabric, which is different from piecing, which is what the G's Bend quilts are. That's where you take several different kinds of fabrics and you piece them together.
Mm-hmm.
So the applique quilts were not seen as a style that was done by African-American quilters. But it was.
Because the Powers quilt is one of the earliest quilts that is still around. And one of the, I think I read somewhere, one of the stories is that it still exists because it was sold to a very well-to-do white family and they treasured and took care of it. It wasn't used a lot as other quilts might have been used on the bed, because so often when a quilt became shreds, it then became the inner workings for the next quilt.
Because it's funny, one of the things that we have learned in this about quilting is that quilting was, we may think of it as an art form, but it was a practical piece
exactly.
of work.
Exactly. Yes.
Things that you use to keep warm, things that you use on an everyday basis. So they showed their wear and tear as they were used.
And you had the mentality of you never throw anything away.
Right.
You saved everything. So what better use to make of old dresses that children had outgrown and pants and that kind of thing, then put them into a quilt for cover and to keep warm.
About maybe 10 years ago, an aunt who was 90 at that point and not well said, maybe go in that bottom drawer down there. So I went, and there was a quilt top that had only been pieced but not finished. And I said, what is this? She says, well, she was born in 1913. Mm-hmm. She said, when I was 5 years old, my great aunt made this for me. And she said, there's your great grandfather's shirt. There's your great grandmother's dress. And it is a very traditional triangular pattern done from their old clothes.
And I distinctly remember my grandmother when she was teaching us quilting, you know, that kind of thing. Just not to be idle was her goal.
Right.
Not to make us quilt makers, but
busy.
Give you something to do. I distinctly remember the Dresden plate, which is a popular pattern that goes back. And the monkey wrench. You know, I remember those patterns in her quilting box.
Can people readily identify the difference between African American quilting and Amish quilting and anyone else's quilting, or is it?
No, they can't tell whether they were done by black hands or hands of another color.
Right.
It's the style of the quilt that I think people associate with different cultures.
Right.
But the process is basically the same.
What's difference in this? What do you mean the style? How would they be different?
Well, Amish quilts are very geometric, very subtle colors, but very gorgeous. If you look at the G's Bend quilts, they're geometric, but they have a different feel to them. Then if you look at the 1930s quilts that were done out of seed sacks, I mean, you can sort of date when the designs or the inspirations came, but you can't tell if you look at a quilt necessarily that what race the person was that made it. Now, you might be able to tell their political leanings or things
oh,
like
yes.
that.
They made very strong political statements in these quilts. And when women didn't have a voice in the political arena, they often made quilts that had a message.
Really?
So, yeah, they're collectors who collect memorabilia from a certain era, a certain president, and the things that they would circulate during a campaign, scarves and handkerchiefs
and then be put into
all
these quilts.
Kinds of things, and be put in these quilts.
And you might be able to guess, not always correctly, from looking at the fabric used in making the quilts. For example, a lot of the African-American quilters will use African fabrics from Africa. And one of my loves is collecting fabric and then sharing it with others. And I consciously search for African fabrics.
You're talking about quilts, a more modern quilts being done now, you mean?
Right,
yes.
Right. Because, you know, you can see slightly a different aesthetic. But so often in today's life, you know, so many cultures cross each other and you're influenced by other people. So I may do a quilt that looks like someone from around the world, but it was because I saw the design, I was influenced by it, and decided I wanted a quilt that looked in this particular way.
Yeah. And now we have the luxury of selecting the fabrics that we want to use. Mm-hmm. We don't always use the leftover fabrics. And there are occasions when you're looking to create a certain look or whatever, you'll go back and get 30s fabric. There are quilters who make just fabrics from just quilts from the 30s, and they will have those colors there, pastels and so forth. I'm more jewel tone and strong colors, so that's what I tend to select.
So we'll talk about these quilts we have here in just a second in the studio. And so, what's the story of your story about the African American quilters of Baltimore? I'm interested in where that began.
Well, the group was started in 1989 by three women who were dabbling in quilting but really wanted to learn more. And that was Melody Healy, Clarissa Price, and Barbara Piatella. And they started meeting in each other's homes. And the word spread, and they grew and they grew and grew. So far, probably for the last 10 or 15 years, we've averaged on 40 or 50 members. And our motto is each one teach one. And most of us have picked up either skills in classes, but shared with each other the things that we know. And each of our meetings now, when we have meetings, we go through business, but we have show and tell so that everybody can show what they've done recently and ask advice. I mean, there are times we get stuck and the rest of the guild will say, oh, we'll do it this way. Oh, no, I do it that way. So it's really a sharing thing all along.
One of the things I read in the article, that as this is one of the Urbanite radio stories that we do, every month we do a bunch of them, one of the things that Barbara said to the reporter in the article was that she didn't feel, she said, when she, is what she said, Barbara Pietla, who's just a lovely human being, and she said she went to the early meetings of the Baltimore Heritage Quilters Guild, but she had to admit that, the quote was, never really felt quite that comfortable with them. I was the only African-American there at the times, and there was the impression that we didn't do quilting.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And also, our members are not all African-Americans.
And not all female.
Correct. You let us in, too?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you know, when we were first asked, you know, I think Kimberly was our first member. When she is also a member of the Heritage, the Baltimore Heritage Group. She says, they're huge. I really like them, but I want a smaller group. Can I join? And we basically said, we will not exclude you. Anyone is welcome. Mm-hmm. You know, you come. So we've got two or three members that are not. And then we've got a new member that's Filipino. We've got one man in the group.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, how I came to be aware of the quilters was my daughter, who made jewelry. And she and Barbara Piatella had taken a class down at Bedazzled.
Okay.
And so on the way out, she was talking about her other passion, which was quilting. So Kim said, well, you should talk to my mom because she loves quilting. And so she brought home Barbara's card. And I called her up and went to visit the next meeting or meeting or two later. I was still working, so I didn't join at that time, but I then later joined.
Now, my entree into the guild was I was exhibiting my work in a gallery in Columbia. And one of the members, Carol Lyles, was a freelance writer for a quilting magazine out of Chicago. And she saw my work, and somehow we got connected, and she interviewed me for the magazine and then invited me to their first show, which was at the Boathouse. I fell in love with them, and I fell in love with the quilts because I really wasn't doing quilting. I was just doing more art with fabric and not quilts. And I was just intrigued and started taking quilting classes. And that happens with a lot of us. You see the beauty and you're like, okay, I need to be part of this.
Right. And my introduction was through a coworker, Joy Daly, who was a member of the guild. And she felt that I should share my stash of fabrics with the world.
We're thankful
because she
to her.
Felt I had too much and needed to get rid of it. And so what I do is when we have shows, I sell fabric.
Folks, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with the folks from the African American Cultures of Baltimore, whose exhibit is about to open at the James E. Lewis Museum of Art here on Morgan State University's campus. It opens on the 7th of August, runs through the 30th. And we're joined by Janet Walters, Vera Hall, and Paula Rooks, all members of that organization whose quilts will be on exhibit. Let's take a shift here. Let's take a look at some of the quilts that you brought and talk about what they are. And folks, as I said, if you want to look at some of these, you can go up on steinershow.org and click on the African American Quilters of Baltimore and see the quilts we're talking about. This is a quilt that hangs in the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. Is that correct?
No, this is Barbara Piatella's work, and all of our publicity shows this signifying. Barbara is known for her story quilts, and this is a brightly colored portrayal of women signifying. You have one on the telephone.
Looking out the window.
Yes, looking out the window. at her neighbors across the yard. You have two ladies whispering to one another. Who knows what they're talking about? Then you have one standing in the doorway greeting another one, and a third listening at the window, probably to their conversation, and the one upstairs hanging out the window. So they're all signifying and checking each other out. How appropriate could that be?
And these are the colors are so vivid and bright. And are these what fabric is this?
All cotton.
This is all cotton.
Mm-hmm.
That's
African American.
Generally,
what did you just say, Vera?
This fabric is generally African.
That's what I thought. Yes. I was about to ask. It's almost like something you'd see on a dashiki.
Exactly.
The fabric
exactly.
on the outside.
Mm-hmm. And Barbara uses most of the time when she does work. It's very bright primary colors.
This is very good.
She always does mm-hmm. three-dimensional embellishments.
So this is
and clearly it tells a story.
And this is, so that's one aspect of the quilts, telling these stories, and
yes.
that's one way to do them.
Every time I see that quilt, I'm reminded of J. California Cooper's story.
Which one?
The one that the woman is watching what everybody else in the neighborhood is doing.
Okay.
She's paying no attention to her children.
Oh.
You know? It's funny.
And that quilt was one that you, this is on the cover of
yes, all of our publications.
All of our publications.
This is your quilt, right, Janet Walters?
Yes.
This is a quilt of your father.
Yes, it's a quilt that I did with photo transfer. There is a way that you can print photographs onto paper. And I did a show some years ago that was called Images of Black Men. And I used his life along with print pictures of his life along with printed word to really chronicle his life, but not his specifically. Basically a life of an average black man that was born in 1915 and how he lived his life.
And his entire life is there. You have on this thing one of his cards that from when he was a Boy Scout. You have...
I've got a war ration book that was my great aunt's. I've got pictures of my father and his brothers from World War II. And my father was a shoemaker that ran a business in Pimlico, and he was very, very close with the Jewish community there. So there's a letter on there from the Jewish Business Association saying what a wonderful contribution he made to the business merchants of the Pimlico area. And then we've got my parents when they were dating and their marriage.
Because this was Pimlico when it was mostly Jewish.
Yes, yes. I mean, I worked there when I was a child to help out on Saturdays, and a lot of his customers were survivors of the Holocaust.
And they have pictures of him
into his aging. Well, pictures of when I was a little girl, pictures when we went to Jones Beach as a child, and
which
then
was the beach black folks had to go to.
Well, Jones Beach in New York.
Oh, that in New York.
In New York.
Cars Beach here, right?
And then I've got pictures. I didn't get married till I was 41, so my father was much older. So pictures of him at my wedding, and just a lot of there's also a panel in there. We had a great family reunion. I have a huge family. There were like 500 people there, and they made him king for the day because he was the elder male of the family.
So, how common is it to do quilts with these photographs like this?
Getting more and more common now because technology allows us to do it. There is paper that you can put into your printer, and it prints the photograph from, or just like written word, from your computer as if it were just on paper.
I love this one. It's just such a beautiful piece, and in subtle tones.
Well, and those were his favorite colors.
And
I sort of used browns. Well, the browns and the blues were his favorite colors. My mother and I thought he looked great in yellow. He hated it. So the whole life we fought him, you're going to wear a yellow shirt. So I specifically put yellow in there. And I did the motif of the hills behind the photographs to sort of symbolize his journey through his life. And I know I'm prejudiced, but my father was one of the most wonderful gentlemen you ever want to meet.
Well, let's look at the next quilt. I mean, one of the things I love about this quilt also is I think this is something that I'd hope that young people would see and think about, just in terms of the image of a black man, the way you describe mm-hmm. him, the way he is described in this quilt. And the idea that he had his own business, he was a shoemaker, did his work, raised a family, you know, that's
my father started at that shop when he was 12 years old delivering, and he worked there as an apprentice and became a master shoemaker. So by the time he went to World War II, he was a master shoemaker. When he came back to work there and eventually bought the business from the daughter.
That's great. What was your father's name?
Raymond Lawrence Waters.
And so now what are we looking here? We sing...
We Two Sing America.
Oh, this is yours.
Yes.
Yes. We Two Sing America. This is the quilt of the Civil War that you spent years researching.
Yes. This has an interesting story of how I came to make that quilt, because I am not a Civil War buff, have never really paid a lot of attention to it. I kind of know what everybody else knows about the Civil War. It was a war between the North and the South for, most people think, the abolition of slavery,
right,
which really wasn't the reason for the war. But in any case, I belong to another guild, which is Village Quilters. And they have a competition where you can win a set of blocks. That month, they had the Civil War blocks, which are these around the outside. They're just simple nine-patch blocks and Civil War colors. And they had teacups, which was an applique set of blocks. So I submitted some blocks for each one, hoping to win the teapots.
Uh-huh.
And I won the Civil War. I tell everybody, I changed history. I won the Civil War. But in any case, the deal is, if you win the blocks, you have to turn it into a quilt. And if you turn it into a quilt within a certain time frame, you get a gift certificate. So I knew I had missed a gift certificate. I was going to make the quilt. So I started researching, where are the fabrics that show there were some blacks in the battles in the Civil War? Because everybody's seen the 54th Regiment and, out of Massachusetts.
Right.
And I couldn't find any. Found absolutely no images of blacks in the Civil War. But I remember that Benjamin Quarles had written about the Negro in the Civil War. That's the title of his book. So my neighbor had the book on her shelf. And I borrowed her book and started reading about the Civil War and the contributions blacks made. Well, I got so intrigued in it. 2 years later, this is the outgrowth. The center panel shows the country as it was at the outbreak of the Civil War in 1861-2. And you see the unsettled territory, and you see the ones that were United States. This is the seceding states, the southern states, and this red represents the bloodshed on both sides of the Civil War.
It's red going through the north and
right,
south,
right,
the states.
Because, as you read about the people and their efforts to free themselves, it's just interesting how they were so integral and could be left out of our history so absolutely. So I attempted to tell the story of the country as well as how we got to be a part of the Civil War and its outcome.
And you have this great photo in here that you've sewn in here, contraband of a young boy who's obviously followed the Union troops. So they were called contraband. The slaves followed the troops to get out of slavery. And then there's another picture of the same boy as a drummer boy dressed up
right,
in uniform.
Right. So that at the beginning of the Civil War, blacks were not allowed to participate in the fighting. And so they followed the troops, and they did other jobs before 1862. And it was after the Battle of Gettysburg, around that time, that the War Department relented and allowed black soldiers. And the pay was like it, had been historically, was not up to what the other soldiers made, and their accommodations were different, and all of that.
So
but they participated.
And how long did it take you to make this quilt?
I think about 2.5 years.
And how many years of research went into this quilt?
Two. Yeah, it took longer to research it than it did actually to
make
it.
It's just an amazing quilt.
Yeah.
I just love it.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
And it's double sided as well. It looks like
the back of it. This is typical of the kind of fabric that I found here, and it's you can't find a black image in it, and that's why the title is "We Two Sing America," from Langston Hughes's poem, to say that I am the darker brother, but nevertheless I'm an American.
So we're here in the studio talking with Janet Walters, Vera Hall, and Paula Rooks, who are all members of the African American Quilters of Baltimore. Janet Walters is the president. I'm sure that doesn't mean she runs the place all by herself, but that's.
She does.
She does. Yes, yes, she does. And their exhibit is opening up at Morgan State University's James E. Lewis Museum of Art on August the 7th. We'll run through September 30th. The opening reception is on August the 7th on Saturday from noon to 4 p.m. Gallery talk will take place at 2 p.m. that day. And 20 years of peaceful passion. And I've learned so much about quilting, and you'll learn a great deal more just kind of going to this exhibit. But let me ask you, a moment ago, you were also talking about, Janet, that there's all kinds of quilting groups around the country. You talked about a group of African-American quilters in Chicago. Share that a minute. That was interesting.
Modern tools and technology has broadened our ability to make images on quilts so much more. And the group in Chicago makes their quilts out of fusible web, which is a fabric that has glue on it, which allows you to adhere two pieces of fabric together. So Vera was talking earlier about applique. Vera sews her applique on by hand. Well, the fusible allows you just to iron it on. And rotary tools, mats, so many modern tools have expanded what we can do visually with the fabric. I mean, it is absolutely amazing. There are people that do embroidery on quilts, that the stitching is as much a part of the design as actually the shapes and colors of the fabric.
And describe for a minute what you mean quilts made by non-traditional traditionalists who use unusual fabrics. And what do you mean by non-traditional traditionalists? What does that mean?
Well, I don't know which one of us said that, but the traditional quilts are either in one or two categories. They're either applique or they're made from piecing pieces together. They can be pieced together in design so that you end up with a design that's repeated over and over again. There's one that's as simple as a diamond shape that's repeated in different colors, lights and darks and so forth. It's traditional, goes back some years. And the Baltimore Applique Society does a lot of research into traditional Baltimore applique. It was a style of applique that was used in Baltimore particularly. And they made designs that kind of told a story, and it was an album. And they often made them to present to a soldier of some sort in high command or a minister or whatever, and they were called Baltimore album quilts. That's a very traditional style, and it's been around since the 1800s, early 1800s.
And then a lot of your blocks, which are incorporated to make up the quilt, have a specific pattern, and then they are assigned a name. So if you see a quilt that has that block, you can identify it as Jacob's Ladder.
Log Cabin.
Bear's Claw.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Or whatever the case might be.
Mm-hmm.
So these are traditional blocks.
With the computer now, you're often getting people who are taking the traditional block and making it in non-traditional ways, so that it's a play on the pattern. You still recognize the pattern, but it's made with an alternative style.
And a lot of quilters now will actually draw a picture, and then they make pattern pieces from that. So that is totally out of the realm of the traditional. They're still using traditional sewing techniques, but the design is their own.
Mm-hmm. One of those is all my design, and the other one is from traditional designs.
Of yours?
Yeah. Yes.
And that's most of mine are all things that I've drawn or designed. I'm not patient with following other people's rules in sewing.
That's a good thing. That's not a bad thing. That's why I like this. I like this. So I want to encourage our listeners, and they can also go to astonishshow.org and click this on, but www.aaqb.org is the African American Cultures of Baltimore's website. And it's worth taking a look there. It's also worth taking a look if you're interested in becoming a quilter or joining a quilting group. They're very open to all comers to learn quilting and to share ideas. And their exhibit, as I said, opens Saturday, August 7th, 2010, just this week at noon. The Saturday to 4 is the opening reception. 2 o'clock is the gallery talk. The exhibit itself runs through September 30th. 20 Years of Peaceful Passion. I love the title of that. The African American Cultures of Baltimore. And Janet Walters, Vera Hall, Paula Rooks, it's great to have you in the studio.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
I really enjoyed this. Thank you so much. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555.